We're talking about the spread of polarization in America this hour, The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. The Democratic Party has become the urban party. People living in city centers lean left. And with the help of statistical data, we're tracing the roots of this back to the time of the Great Depression. And we'll hear the contemporary implications today of our staunchly two-party system. So what questions do you have about our nation's urban-rural political divide? What do you want to know about the tendencies of voters in cities versus in the suburbs or in rural areas? Join in at any point this hour, 800-642-1234. Jonathan Rodin is a political science professor at Stanford University. He's the author of the new book. It's called Why Cities Lose: The Deep Roots of the Urban-Rural Political Divide. Jonathan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you're going to help us really paint a picture for what this rural-urban divide looks like. And so to start this picture for us, can you take us to Pennsylvania, where you've been looking at recent Pennsylvania elections, and you found it really interesting to basically show an urban-rural divide?
Oh, yes, it certainly goes way beyond Pennsylvania, but it's a kind of a nice case study to look at, and one that maybe has some good lessons for Wisconsin as well. But when we look at precinct-level election results in a place like Pennsylvania, we see a correlation between population density and Democratic voting that is really there at every geographic level and every part of the state. So it's something that I think everyone kind of knows, that Philadelphia and Pittsburgh are very Democratic, and the rest of the state is more Republican. But one of the things that we see when we really zoom in the precinct level data is that this is true also of much smaller cities. When we get to places like Allentown and Scranton, State College, and even smaller places, that this correlation between density and Democratic voting is there in almost every county in the state, is especially strong in the more industrialized places.
So how do you break down population density? How do you define what is urban and what is rural in your work?
Well, I think there are lots of different ways to do that. And one of the difficult things about it is that most Americans now live in suburbs, which are kind of medium density places. And there can be real differences between different types of suburbs. But as a first cut, I just look at the precincts, which are very small units at which we have political data. And we can also then kind of overlay the boundaries of the precincts on the census data, and we can get a sense for race and income and some other things at that level. But we can just look at the number of people per square mile and get a sense of density. And that's the claim I was making a moment ago, is just that the density is highly correlated with voting behavior in ways that are even stronger than some of the other variables that we're accustomed to thinking about, like income and race.
And so when you look at a city like Philly, a very large city, you're saying that it leans Democrat, and it has for a long time. Why is that?
Well, that's the great question, and it's one that I don't think we've fully answered yet, but it's one that has a number of different answers. I think a good way to start answering that question is to ask, well, when did this first happen and why? Going back into this historical data, we see that Philadelphia, along with Pittsburgh, had a Republican machine in its politics in the early part of the 20th century, so it certainly hasn't always been the case. But Philadelphia was one of those cities that in the 30s and 40s, in the era of the New Deal, where it was a place where workers and members of labor unions started to affiliate with the Democratic Party in large numbers in that era. So I think it started with the economic dimension of politics and labor unions and labor activism, and that's kind of where it started. And we still see the legacy of that in lots of places, in the communities that had strong labor unions and a lot of worker mobilization in the early part of the 20th century. Those places are still Democratic strongholds today. But that can't be the whole story, because this correlation between density and Democratic voting really increased in the 80s and 90s, an era when labor unions were on the decline. And so I think at that point, there are some other issues that really helped explain the growth of the urban-rural divide. And there, I think it's important to look more at issues like social issues. But it's also the case that there's been a real economic transformation of some of these cities and the rise of the knowledge economy in urban areas and the growing affiliation of the Democratic Party with the knowledge economy. So there's kind of an economic transformation combined with a real change in social issues that has increased this urban-rural divide.
We're talking about the influence that geography has in our elections with Jonathan Roden. He's a professor of political science at Stanford, author of the new book called Why Cities Lose. You can share your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. What voting patterns have you noticed in your community? Have you looked at past election results when deciding where to live? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Jonathan, Wisconsin has a couple well-known liberal strongholds in Milwaukee and Madison. Would you say that Wisconsin's situation is similar at all to Pennsylvania?
I think it's becoming more similar over time. I find Wisconsin kind of fascinating. I mean, as I'm sitting here, I'm looking at an electoral map of the 2008 election. And one of the things that's distinctive about Wisconsin, at least was distinctive until fairly recently, is that rural Wisconsin has been much more Democratic than the rural areas in other states. And so, as you were asking about urban a minute ago, it's also important to be clear about what we mean by rural. There are a number of Democratic strongholds that are just small cities, small old industrial cities out in Wisconsin. But it was also the case that some of places in rural Wisconsin, especially in the western part of the state, were quite Democratic. And part of that, I think, has to do with mining history. But in the last couple of elections, these places have come to look much more like rural places in the rest of the country, in that rural Wisconsin is becoming increasingly Republican, and these old Democratic strongholds in the cities have become even more Democratic. And so there's been really a pronounced increase in urban-rural polarization in Wisconsin in recent years. So it's come to look more like the rest of the country. It was at one time more distinctive on this dimension.
Do you see voting patterns in Wisconsin consistent with what is going on in the rest of the country?
Yes, I think it's become more similar to states to the south of Wisconsin. I'm from Missouri, and it has been the case for a long time that there was a divide between St. Louis and Kansas City on the one hand, and the rest of the state. There was that divide was less pronounced in the past in Wisconsin, but now it looks a lot more like Missouri. But a big difference, though, is that Wisconsin has a lot more scattered, medium-sized and smaller cities. It has it has a very different industrial history than a place like Missouri, and it is the Democrats are a bit more dispersed throughout the state in Wisconsin than they are in a place like Missouri, where in Missouri they're just highly concentrated in these two cities.
We're talking about elections this hour with political scientist Jonathan Roden. He makes the case in his new book that geography and our election system has created systemic disadvantages for Democrats. The book is called Why Cities Lose. Gathering your thoughts, your questions there, welcome along the way. How do you think Democrats could be working to connect with suburban and rural voters? What do you think are the Democratic Party's biggest election challenges? Do you agree the party faces disadvantages due to geography? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. We're talking about what geography has to do with politics and representation in Congress. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're tracing this history of how an increasing concentration of Democrats live in big cities today and why that then is a problem for representation in our two-party system. Democrats end up being efficiently distributed across districts, even when Democrats themselves have drawn up the districts. That's the case laid out in the new book, Why Cities Lose. Your thoughts are welcome along the way, 800-642-1234. Are you a Democrat who lives in the suburbs or in a rural community? Do you think the party is too focused on urban issues? What should the party be doing differently? Are you a Republican who lives in the city? Do you feel left out ever, out of the party? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Author Jonathan Rodin stays with us. Let's take a call now. Pam is joining us from Southwest Wisconsin. Hi, Pam.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just thinking there was a comment the other minute about Southwest Wisconsin maybe because of our mining history or something being a little more progressive. And what I know out here in Southwest Wisconsin is there are a lot of rural progressives that I think people assume that Madison is the stronghold. But because I think of our organic farming, what we call out here organic urban refugees come out to work the organic farms. So there's a real progressive move out here, you know, Code Pink and Waldorf School, you know, people who are thinking much more progressively. And so I think sometimes Democrats and other forget sort of the rural progressives. And I think I see it largely out of our organic farming in the area.
Pam, thanks so much for that microcosm and pulling out some words that Pam used, rural progressive, urban refugees. Jonathan, what do we know there?
Yeah, that's a nice observation, and I think there are some other. I mean, that's I think one of the stories about Southwest Wisconsin, because there's got to be some. You know, when you look at the maps, it's really pretty striking. There are not a lot of places in the United States that are that level of density that are as democratic as Southwest Wisconsin. Yeah, I mean it's changed a little bit over time. In the last election, it was much less democratic than it had been. But it certainly does stand out. And I think this idea of urban refugees is something we can see in other places as well. Maybe the entire state of Vermont or a big chunk of it, one could tell a similar story. It's also a relatively non-urban place that has a lot of progressives who once lived in New York City or in Massachusetts. Places like this in Colorado, whenever we find a kind of, a lot of these resort kind of communities like ski towns and places like that tend to be very democratic, and some of the surrounding areas. But this organic farming communities are certainly another part of that story.
Jonathan, take us way back to the Industrial Revolution and help us connect the dots, tracing this urban-rural political divide. What was happening in those days that really set the stage for our current polarization?
Yeah, it was an era when labor unions were beginning to form, and organizers were starting to make a kind of distinctive set of demands. And what I do in the book is try to link this, try to see the United States as not at all isolated in this. This was something that was happening around the world in the late 1800s and the early 1900s, especially in Europe. And there were lots of immigrants coming to the United States from European countries where this labor mobilization was happening. And Milwaukee is a great example of a place where there was a real socialist movement in the 1800s and early 1900s. Reading, Pennsylvania, and Milwaukee, Bridgeport, Connecticut. There were a few of these little places, and I think one of the links that connects them is German immigrants. So there were socialist movements in some U.S. cities, and one of the things that happened in the Great Depression and around the organization of the New Deal is that a lot of the thunder of those socialist parties was stolen by the Democrats. We don't think of the Democrats as having that kind of an origin because they've been so many different things to many different people throughout their history. But there was this moment when the Democrats really became the party of urban labor, urban working class. And that kind of started to structure the basic cleavage of American politics at around the time of the New Deal. And this is very similar to European countries where we did have the emergence of socialist and social democratic parties that were attached to labor unions. And that kind of created the basis for the left-right organization of politics in Europe. And it put the U.S. down a similar path in the era of the Depression.
What was happening in the Deep South with Republicans and Democrats alike for those parties? And then what changed in the civil rights movement?
Yeah, that's something that, you know, it's hard to, a lot of what I'm describing is sort of hard to see if you just take a look at the United States as a whole, because the Democrats in the South were such a different kind of party. So the Democrats were, you know, the way the New Deal was able to achieve, was able to get through Congress was by kind of making a coalition between the urban working class and the Southern Democrats, who were really the party of racial oppression in the South. And so the Democrats were incredibly divided on issues related to race, because as a result of the Great Migration and the growth of an urban working class of African Americans in northern cities, it started to be the case that some of the base of the Democratic Party, the working class base of the party in the cities, was African Americans, and they start pushing the Democratic Party to embrace civil rights, which is something that takes a long time for them to do, but eventually they do. And then the long-term story of that is the realignment of the party system and the Democrats adopting civil rights, and the decline of the Southern Democrats and the transformation of the party system in the South.
We're exploring the influence of geography in our elections with Jonathan Roden as our guide. He's a political science professor at Stanford. New book is called Why Cities Lose. You can join in 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about our country's urban-rural divide? What do you want to know about it? What do you think contributed to our nation's polarized politics? Why are Democrats concentrated in cities? How do you see it? Join in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Jonathan, as city families started flocking to the suburbs in later decades, why didn't the suburbs at all become strongholds for Democrats?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that you know, the suburbanization is something that's happened in not just in the United States, but in lots of countries around the world. I think we think of it as an exclusively American phenomenon, but there's a part of the story in which it's just people in the parties start to respond to the interests of people in different places. But then there's this other part of the story in which people actually pick up and move. People with distinctive political preferences start to move, and it does seem to be the case that the folks who picked up and left city centers, especially in an era, kind of post-industrial era, where the cities really start to become more more dangerous and less appealing places to live, higher income people start moving to the suburbs. People who have a preference for larger houses and more space, and there's some kind of there's an interesting correlation between that set of preferences and people's partisan preferences. And so we see this era of suburbanization and sorting really starts actually pretty early. It starts in the middle of the century, and by the 50s, it really was quite pronounced.
How do you measure when people just flat out want to live with other like-minded people? How much of the concentration of Democrats in cities is systemic versus just wanting to be near a neighbor who thinks like them?
Yeah, there's been that's been a kind of a, I think most people, when confronted with these, you know, incredible data on the concentration of Democrats in space, I think that's the natural answer that we start to think about is that it must be people choosing to live among others who think the way they do. And I certainly think that happens on some scale, but I think it couldn't possibly explain all that much of the phenomenon. I think it's part of the story, but people just don't move in large enough numbers to have created the dramatic urban-rural polarization we've seen since the 80s and 90s. It kind of just doesn't add up. When we look at the transformation of rural places, you see some places that have very stable populations. It can't be that all the Democrats picked up and moved, and that's how rural America became more Republican. I think we have to look at explanations about how the party's platforms have changed over time, how the Democrats have embraced a different set of issues that has led the rural folks to migrate to the Republican Party. And something similar has happened within cities. You know, there were lots more cities were a lot more politically heterogeneous in the past. So it's not all sorting in terms of just people moving, but that's certainly a part of the story.
We're exploring our country's urban-rural political divide with political scientist Jonathan Roden. New book is called Why Cities Lose. Your thoughts and questions are welcome throughout the hour, 800-642-1234. Do you live near Milwaukee, Madison, or another urban community? What have you noticed about the politics of your city compared to the suburbs, compared to rural small towns? What do you think are Democrats' biggest election challenges? Do you agree the party faces disadvantages due to geography? We'll continue this look. You can join in right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're learning about how political geography works, how it could perhaps undermine political representation in our country. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Republicans often cite Wisconsin's urban-rural divide to cast Democrats as being out of touch with rural voters. And here's Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who was on our program last month while talking about the 2018 elections.
The fact is, Democrats do not appeal to rural voters because their agenda is a far left agenda. And that's why Governor Evers did not do as well as Tammy Baldwin did and did not carry the majority of the district. So it's really not focused on the idea of creating a different map. It's just that Democrats can't win because their agenda only focuses on very liberal big city voters.
What questions do you have about our nation's urban-rural political divide? We're at 800-642-1234. We're exploring this with Jonathan Roden. He is a political science professor at Stanford, and his new book is called Why Cities Lose. He stays with us. Jonathan, you just heard that clip from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. What is the role of partisan gerrymandering here, and why do you think that it's not the whole problem?
Yes, I mean, we're half an hour into talking about this, and we haven't talked about gerrymandering.
We
yet.
Haven't
and,
let you know, the G word drop. Oh my goodness!
And in Wisconsin, you know, I think for the rest of the country, you know, Wisconsin is a case that is very important because of the Gill v. Whitford lawsuit and the Supreme Court case and everything that flowed from that. And so it's certainly it's hard. So this is has been for some time now the difficulty in thinking about how to prove to courts that gerrymandering is happening and that it's important is that people intuitively know that there is this geographic story as well. And so I want to be clear, and I think it's clear in the book also, that to point out that geography matters is by no means to say that gerrymandering does not matter. The effort is to try to show how the two kind of bolster one another, that having Democrats already very concentrated in cities really helps. It helps the job of a Republican gerrymandering expert. It becomes rather easy. It's in some states, it's so easy to draw a pro-Republican gerrymander that you don't even need to try. If you just let a computer draw the districts in a way that facilitates compactness and contiguity of districts, you end up with a fairly nice Republican gerrymander. And then if you work a little bit harder at it, you can make it even better. Wisconsin is an interesting state because we were talking earlier about how there are Democrats kind of scattered around in the Fox River area, you know, along in sort of in Neenah and Oshkosh and Green Bay and, you know, outside of Milwaukee. There are lots of Democratic strongholds. So Democrats are actually better dispersed in Wisconsin than a lot of states. And so it turns out that much of the story, especially in the Wisconsin House of Representatives, has to do with gerrymandering. And geography is less a force in the lower chamber. As we get into the U.S. Congress, I think geography is more of a role. But clearly, the two, geography and gerrymandering, work together. And especially Wisconsin is a place where I think gerrymandering probably has more to do with the asymmetry between the votes and the seats than does just pure geography.
So would nonpartisan election maps, if they can exist, would that balance the geographic advantage that you argue Republicans have in our current election system?
Well, I think the devil there is in the details of what kind of nonpartisan maps are we talking about. Unfortunately, I think it even matters which, as I was just suggesting, which chamber are we talking about, the state house, the state senate, or Congress. These are very different geographic scales, and what happens when you draw districts really changes as you move up and down these geographic scales. But I think, kind of speaking more broadly beyond Wisconsin, it's the case that if we just give a nonpartisan, you know, computer algorithm the job of drawing the districts, and we just ensure that they look nice, you know, that they're compact and all the districts are contiguous, there will be some settings in which that will still be a problem for the Democrats. Certainly be better than having Republican operatives draw the districts, but in some places it would still be a problem. So then the question for the Democrats is, well, what kind of redistricting reform do you want to try to push for? And so some Democrats have latched onto the idea of trying to create rules in the redistricting process that require the commission to achieve some sort of partisan fairness. And then that becomes a difficult thing to measure, and that will probably lead to some more court fights. But that's so just saying let's create a commission only begins the conversation about what kind of commission and what kind of rules should they be operating with.
Let's bring in Larry now from Sun Prairie with thoughts on this. Larry, hi.
Oh, hi. Say, thanks for having this discussion. I'm 68. I voted in every election I can ever remember. I don't think I've missed any, even primaries. You want to talk about urban versus rural. I see in elections that there's a lot of rural signs and push for sportsmen for Republicans or sportsmen for a Republican candidate. But Dems don't do a very good job of marketing themselves that way. I lean progressive, and I own a lot of guns, and I pass them down to my grandkids. Hunting is a valuable thing to know in Wisconsin. It's a recreational or a tourist state. We're woodsy. Democrats hunt; they own guns. In fact, Democrat men and women. So it should be sportsmen and sportswomen for Democrats. A lot of people don't realize the party of Lincoln was basically closer to the Democratic Party of today, as far as I know. I could be wrong on that, but I don't think I am. Fighting Bob LaFollette was a Republican.
Uh-huh.
And the last thing, you know, this clip from Robin Voss, he really didn't say anything. It's just sour grapes type speech. If he thinks education, healthcare, and our infrastructure, such as roads, are far-left policies that he's attacking, you know, basically Tony Evers, that's totally bogus.
And,
good at marketing this stuff.
Yeah, so Larry is looking at identity there, Jonathan, and what have you seen?
Well, you know, he's also talking about this idea of marketing and of perceptions, and I think that's important. You know, I think that one of the things I'm trying to understand the United States context. You know, in Britain or Australia, in a parliamentary system, a party has a platform, and you can go and read that platform. It's a very high profile thing, and a party in a parliamentary system is promising that if they get elected, they will implement that platform. In the United States, we don't really have anything like that. We have a lot of people with a D next to their name in Congress saying various things. And those things are quite heterogeneous. And there are Democrats who get elected from more rural areas who have more views on, for instance, guns that are more consistent with those of rural residents. But the question is, what do people hear about the Democrats' platform? And we are in an environment right now where a lot of what they hear is what the latest thing is that AOC may have said. So the perception of the Democratic platform is one that is driven by its urban incumbents, in part, and that's a problem for the Democrats. They're you know, this, and this feeds into the it allows for the kind of quote that we just heard from the speaker in Wisconsin. They can kind of point to, look, these are the platforms of the Democratic Party. And there may be others in the Democratic Party who say, no, those aren't the platforms that I know of. But those are the ones that we hear the most about in the media. So that's a bit of a problem that they face. And it has a geographic root. It may not seem to, but it has this root in geography.
If you're just joining us, we're exploring the influence of geography in our elections with Jonathan Rodin. He is a political science professor at Stanford. His new book is called Why Cities Lose: The Deep Roots of the Urban-Rural Political Divide. Your questions, your thoughts, they're welcome. 800-642-1234. Have you moved from a city to the suburbs or from the countryside to a city? What differences did you notice in voting patterns? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Jonathan, you use the word bundling and unbundling quite a bit through your analysis and how different issues get latched on to the party. How does that work in terms of what a party represents?
Right, you know, we were talking a few minutes ago about the early days of the New Deal, and when politics in the United States was very much about economics. But then we talked about a period in which the racial dimension was introduced and civil rights was introduced, and that became part of what the party's platforms were associated with. Then in the 80s, we had abortion after the Roe versus Wade decision and the kind of orientation of the parties with different platforms on abortion, because in the 70s, it was unclear. If you didn't like abortion, it was unclear which party you should vote for. And now we're seeing something similar on immigration and something similar on free trade, where an issue where the parties didn't really have distinctive platforms in the past, they start to develop distinctive platforms, and the parties become increasingly complex bundles. What we see in European party systems, where there might be 5-6 parties, is that we see that on these different issues, you get different parties kind of bundling different issues together. In the U.S., we've only got these two big parties. And they bundle together all sorts of different issues, from gun rights, as the caller was pointing out, to economics, to abortion. And it just happens to be the case that the Democrats have bundled together a lot of issues that are of interest to urban residents. And over time, the Republicans have bundled together a lot of these issues that are of interest to rural residents. And that's kind of what drives the growing polarization. In the book, I claim it's because of the growth of more and more issues that kind of get tacked on to the existing party system.
We're talking about elections this hour with Jonathan Rodin, who argues in a new book that geography in our election system has created systemic disadvantages for Democrats. The book is called Why Cities Lose. You can join in. Do you see an urban-rural divide from your vantage point? How do you think the Republican Party could be connecting with more urban voters? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this conversation in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at this urban-rural divide in our political system. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and the book is called Why Cities Lose. Political scientist Jonathan Rodin quotes former House Speaker Paul Ryan to make a point. Ryan said in 2017, quote, "We basically run a coalition government without the efficiency of a parliamentary system." And Paul Ryan was frustrated with how fractured the Republican Party was, but also showing why third parties don't get a toehold in our politics. Still time for your thoughts, 800-642-1234. And Jonathan Rodin stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now with Marcus in Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus.
Good morning, Kate. So my comment or my thoughts on this is I feel like we actually just need to take and come away from these polar extremes that we have for the Republicans and Democrats, stop looking at the parties, and actually start taking a common sense approach to various issues. You know, you had Bill Clinton was able to pull a lot of people more towards the center by working and trying to find more compromises. Prior to that, you had Ronald Reagan with the Reagan Democrats. And Ronald Reagan took it to the people and said, hey, look, this is what I'm trying to do. And he came with a common sense approach that people could reason with it and go, yeah, that makes sense. And so I think if we took and stepped away from, well, I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican, and started actually looking at issues in a practical way, I think that we could find a lot more consensus. And it's really that consensus which has made America great, and we need to get back to that.
How do you strip out politics, Jonathan? How do you find a centrist view?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to the to that argument, and it's so there's kind of a we're hearkening back to this era of bipartisanship and the fact that the entire period of the Reagan administration, the Democrats controlled Congress, and yet there were not debt showdowns and crises, and there wasn't constant series of investigations and so forth. So I think part of the story there is that the parties were just a lot less. Political competition was less nationalized. One could run as a Democrat in a rural district or in a kind of a mixed district. One could run as a pro-life Democrat or a pro-gun Democrat. And really, that was the way in which Democrats formed their legislative majorities right up until the 90s, when we had the Contract with America and a real nationalization of political competition. I mean, there's a lot more to that story than just Newt Gingrich deciding that it should be that way. But there has been this nationalization of politics and of the parties and of fundraising that has made it harder to achieve what the caller was describing. I think it's still not impossible. It's also, because of all the bundling of issues that the parties have put together, it means that there are lots of people who vote for Democrats who disagree with a big chunk of what the Democrats do, and the same way with Republicans. It has to be that way because there's so much that is bundled together by those parties. So being able to kind of get around that and have more heterogeneous candidates within the parties in some ways is the only solution. If we're going to stick with a two-party system, those parties have to be heterogeneous, and they are. But there's a battle that is taking place within the parties, within both parties right now, and it certainly could. I think it's entirely possible that the parties could start to move, because they need to, because they're forced to, in the direction that the caller describes. I think it's not hopeless.
Let's bring in Lori now from Hale's Corners. Hi, Lori.
Hi. Good show. I want to give you an additional factor to look at. My husband and I are older, 80s, 90s, okay? And we are living in a senior living facility in Hales Corners. The last ballot came around, there were many names on that ballot, people that we had never heard of. Imagine trying to get adequate information about each of those candidates at that time, in time to make up our minds. That's hard. So I am proposing to our village staff, I used to be active in the League of Women Voters, I am proposing that we have a league-style forum, candidate forum, to introduce candidates to the public, to their people trying to figure out who to vote for, okay? And I think that should be added to your list there, and you talk about the gerrymandering. Guess what? We have a larger number of older people still living and still attempting to vote today.
Lori, because we're short on time, I want to bring Jonathan in to address the older generation and what they bring to your research in mapping.
Yeah, I think age is something that is also correlated with geography. A lot of city centers tend to be younger, and urban of older voters tend to be more dispersed, especially in suburban and rural areas. One thing that the caller points out that really leaps out in the data is that turnout is really high among older voters typically, and there's a kind of surprisingly large correlation between age and turnout. And it's just pretty amazing how low is the turnout among young Americans, especially urban young Americans. But the other point about, I assume the caller is specifically referring to primaries where there are lots of candidates on the ballot. When we're talking about a preference of lots of folks for more moderate candidates, figuring out who those people are and allowing their message to get through can actually be hard. And we can end up with some polarization driven by what's happening in the primaries and some aspects of fundraising and name recognition and all of that. Primaries are an important part of the story, and getting greater exposure for more moderate candidates is certainly not a bad idea.
Let's bring in Mike now in Rusk County. Good morning, Mike.
Hi. I just wanted to point one. First of all, I agree with the guests on a lot of these issues, and I think this isn't my sole point, but the centrality that drives where cities are located and how they're driven and so forth, that's driven by economic and geographic factors. But then the social aspects of being in a city are driven by not by the geography, but by being in a city, or people are in your face and next to you all day long. But the point I wanted to make is that they're the real turning point in the state of Wisconsin, for at the governor's level, for doing a hard right turn with Scott Walker, in my opinion, comes out of issues like, as identified by the guests, things like concealed carry. Concealed carry was vetoed by Jim Doyle against a bipartisan group of legislatures, and that was a huge issue in the rural area of the state. I can tell you that if you went into a tavern or a restaurant or a coffee shop anywhere in northern Wisconsin, shortly after that bill got vetoed, that was the talk of the town.
And, Mike, I want to pause right there on concealed carry and you pointing out that one issue was a turning point for elections. Jonathan Roden, do you see those types of turning points, those hard edges there?
Yeah, I think that they have moved in the direction of that type of an issue, where in the past it would have been economic issues. It seems to be more and more other kinds of issues, and I can't really give you some kind of a good quantitative indicator of guns versus abortion, versus other kinds of policies. But the more of those that get added on, we start seeing these turning points where the urban-rural divide suddenly emerges, and sometimes it's more gradual. In Wisconsin, it was really kind of sudden.
Well, in the last seconds we have with you, when you look at what you know about geography and all of this data that you've collected and the history layered on that, what reforms could you see on the horizon?
Yeah, the question of what reform would I like to see if I had a magic wand, and what do I see on the horizon, are probably very, very different. I am fond of a more proportional electoral systems, mainly because I like the idea of moving beyond the kind of duopoly of two parties and having more voices in the political process. But I don't see a big constitutional reform like that as being on the horizon. So in terms of reform, I think there is certainly value in trying to change the process of redistricting. And one of the nice things about that is I think it can be bipartisan. I think there's plenty of evidence from states like Michigan
that we can work together. Jonathan, thank you so much for your time. Jonathan Roden, a professor of political science at Stanford, author of Why Cities Lose, The Deep Roots of the Urban-Rural Political Divide. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network. The Morning Show is produced by Colleen Leahy, Laura Pavin, Jana Rose Schleiss, Courtney Everett, Keegan Kyle, Chris Molina, and Brianne Shasso. Lee Rayburn is our technical director, and Keely Baltina is our executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.